Let me go ahead and call us to order here and welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace. My name is Lawrence Wucher, here with the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. It's my pleasure to welcome you here to this discussion on community-centered conflict prevention and preparedness. I have a great panel. I don't want to take up too much time. Let me just quickly acknowledge Roshan Paul and Ann Hopper, who did a project for me recently that made some series of recommendations that got me thinking more about this and part of the impetus for this project, for this panel today. So thanks to them. And thanks to our panelists. I'll introduce them quickly. And you have their full bios. First, we'll hear from Casey Bars, who's a fellow at the CUNY Center, named after Fred CUNY, the prominent humanitarian. He's got a long history of work in humanitarian NGOs in the field in various places. And he'll really make an argument for community-centered approaches and lay out some conceptual ideas as well as some practical recommendations. Then we'll hear from Patrick Meyer, who's a doctoral candidate at the Fletcher School and a research fellow at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. Been involved in a variety of early warning system development over the years. Patrick, I think, will focus his comments on a project he's been involved in Timor-Leste, which illustrates some of these kinds of community-centered approaches. And then Linda Poteet, who directs disaster response at Interaction, the coalition of NGOs here in Washington. And she's has also a long history of humanitarian work in the field. And we'll make some comments on the general approach as well as perhaps from the perspective of operational NGOs on the ground, both what can we learn from them about conflict prevention and preparedness and how are these ideas relevant to those kinds of actors. So without further ado, Casey.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's a good turnout. The CUNY Center, not to be confused with the City University of New York, which often happens, is an applied research and educational institute that tries to find practical solutions to the needs of societies affected by conflict. As Lawrence just said, it was founded by a remarkable man named Fred CUNY in 1987. Originally, it was called Intertect. It was renamed for him after he disappeared in Chechnya in 1995. His ideas and his works continue to inform the activities of the center, including some of the ideas you'll be hearing today. Incidentally, Fred CUNY was one of the initiators of the International Crisis Group, and he had argued that ICG should have an operational capacity, a capacity to respond to crises, in addition to its strong, you know, monitoring and advocacy role. It didn't turn out that way. But it's interesting now that USIP itself is also looking at ways it might become more aggressively, maybe aggression is not the right word, more assertively applied in the field, operational in conflict settings. However that works out, I applaud you for looking that direction. You do have in front of you this little half sheet. It's your 60-second homework assignment. If you kindly just jot the first thing that comes to mind, I'll give you a minute. And then if you wouldn't mind, just maybe at the table, pass them around this way. And if you in the chairs, if you wouldn't mind, pass them over here. And I'll grab them and maybe have a short comment on them halfway into this talk. Some of those pens are really flying. Okay, this is like in West Point, you all got to drop your pencils. And if you wouldn't mind kindly passing it around. It's not a surprise, it's not news to anyone here, that humanitarian aid suffers deadly transitions in the face of violence. And when that happens, millions of people, including our former beneficiaries, our local staff, and our partners, are put at risk. The gist of today's talk is that we can begin helping them physically prepare themselves today for the violence they may face after we're separated tomorrow. I'm talking about what's called humanitarian tactical training. It supports local capacity in three areas. One is security, another is economic survival, and the third is local service delivery. It can be conducted either in communities or in camps. Incidentally, this has important potential, important implications for the areas of conflict mitigation and, in some ways, at some levels, conflict management as well, which we'll circle back to before this talk's over. I think we probably all can agree that there are mindsets and there are skill sets that are proven to save lives in the face of violence, in the face of emergencies, that is. Civilians are capable of absorbing these mindsets and adopting these skill sets. This is seen to us in many disciplines and many endeavors. We could probably also agree that there are specialized trainers out there for hire today who can help impart some of these things. Tactical capacity can be broadly self-replicated through a training of trainers, or in this case, a training of wardens. The instruction I'm talking about has some precedents, and of course it has some risks. There are concrete ways to try to reduce the risk that we can go over, but nevertheless, there are times and places you're not going to want to try this. There are places I have worked in the camps outside of Peshawar in the 80s that were highly politicized, in the camps outside of Goma, Zaire in the 90s that were highly militarized, that I wouldn't have thought this advisable. Much depends on the setting, and it really all comes down to a risk benefit calculation that has to be made. You might not know it, but some of the most authoritative institutions and individuals in the aid world have been saying for some time that we should support the local capacity for self-preservation, but it's not happening on any scale. Don't get me wrong, there's a world of capacity building going on out there, but scant little in regard to how to stay out of harm's way. I'll cite some precedents, but to my knowledge, and I'm welcome to be corrected on it, I don't know that there's anything happening right now as physical, practical, tactical as what we'll talk about today. And nothing is grounded in the tactics that civilians often pursue in order to survive, and in the tactics that our local staff and local partners often pursue in order to continue service after we leave them. Perhaps just have a, I'm going to say have a look at the green sheets, but for all of you it might not be green. I think we ran out of copies and it turned white. The top of it says what preparedness might look like. And you could take a very short time to look at those first three pages. I'm going to look at the responses you just handed back in. But these are, mind you, these are vignettes. These are not the training modules that we'll be talking about shortly. But it'll give you a sense of how civilians might better react in the face of conflict and how our local partners and staff might better be prepared for violence. Well, there's more responses actually right now than I have a chance to look through, and it's very interesting. But so far, it's basically split right down the middle. Half of you are mentioning reconciliation, conflict resolution, negotiation, mediation type strategies, and others are talking more in terms of practical measures such as stockpiling, early warning, detecting threats, and that type of thing. So, very interesting. Let me say a word briefly about those critical transitions in the humanitarian aid enterprise that I had mentioned. We know that we are frequently incapacitated in our efforts to help civilians. With that knowledge, I mean, knowing that, should come an obligation to help capacitate them. I've framed it in ethical terms, and I think it's proper to talk about ethics here. Just below those green sheets you were looking at is, in this case, it's blue. It indicates some of the transition points. It indicates three of them, and I want to say a word about that. Leading up to the first transition in which we may have to cut services or pulling out, you know, there's going to be a time, there's going to be an interval of, say, insecurity when we're worried that someday we may need to evacuate for the safety of our staff, or we may feel that our aid is being so badly abused and manipulated that we may need to withdraw on those grounds. Then there comes a day when we actually do. We cut back services, we pull out, and it is the hardest thing that aid organizations have to do. I had to do it in Somalia, and it was the hardest thing I had to do as an aid worker. It feels as though we're abandoning people. I'm not calling it that, and I'm not even second-guessing that hard decision to pull out. But what I am asking is, do we at least do it strategically? That is, did we make any provision at all for our beneficiaries' future safety or sustenance? Probably not. We probably came to assume that was the responsibility of the people in pinstripe suits and blue helmets to take care of that. But during all that time that our prevention efforts were struggling, did we help prepare the people we work with and for the failure to prevent violence? And all the times that we were getting warnings out, usually wired up and out to foreign media or distant capitals or international bodies, all the time we were getting little response to those warnings, did we also try to support local capacity for early warning response? Probably not. Before we pulled out, did we make any provision for our local staff and partners? Well, this is one area where we are getting a little bit better and thinking a little more strategically. That's a reference to the second transition you see there, where it says we pull out and work remotely. This is referring to remote programming, which some of you may have been aware of and tracking the last few years. It's when the expatriates pull out and hand over the keys to the shop to locals to run operations. It's an innovation, and to me, one of the most important things about that innovation is it shows trust. We are leaving them to run the shop. We trust that they'll have the integrity and bravery to do this in our absence. I think that's important. It's important for this training, certainly. But clearly a weakness of remote programming remains security of the people we've left behind. Many point out this is an ethical issue to our outsourcing or offloading risk to people that we're leaving in charge of a vulnerable vehicle we've lacked the imagination or the creativity to retrofit. Fortunately, they've shown the creativity in several crises now, and we can learn from that, as this training will show. Lastly is a transition point in which they either lose or leave their refuge, and there are varied ways that that happens. Consider how ill-prepared they are when this happens, and also consider how we're partly to blame. Untold numbers have left our camps when conditions became dire. Well, conditions become dire sometimes because of underfunding or overcrowding to the point of, you know, endemic disease, the societal breakdown in camps. Camps also become dire when they're dangerously politicized or militarized by factions. These are our camps. Been there, done that. Likewise, millions are forced back into danger when our asylum constricts. And as most of you may know, the asylum regimen that's been in place for over half a century around the world is in its most dire state since its inception. There are instances, rare but very tragic, even where our safe havens collapse, and the result is that thousands are massacred on site or even more put into flight. And finally, and I'm dwelling on this because I am trying to set up a situation where there's an obligation, whether for peace workers or development workers, what have you, that we have tried to do things and we've spent our time with these people in a certain way, but then that none of us were prepared for the outcome. You know, millions go back to supposedly post-conflict situations, maybe under truces that we helped broker, under promises of repatriation and reconstruction. Then too often, all reverts to violence. We've seen this far too many times. We are bound up in each other's fates. We're separated from each other, and then they walk right back into violence. I think at each transition point, we do need to ask, how did we spend those months and years with these people? Did we invest at all in their capacity for self-preservation, as some authorities have been urging us to do? Certainly our actions, our words, our actions support their human rights while we're with them and even after we're separated from them. But a right is just a possibility. It needs more than legal and verbal force to, they need more than legal and verbal force to fulfill what's due them. They need tactical ability. There are over 70,000 treaties in the world ensuring human rights, but not one teaches civilians how to brace their livelihoods for conflict, shows them how to avoid a surprise raid or recognize an ambush trap. Rights require means. A few words about the feasibility of this. There are, as I mentioned, three concentrations, the security one, and as well as economic survival and service capacity. I'll probably focus a bit more on security now because it's derived from police and military practice, and it's the most sensitive, obviously. But all three are doable, including security instruction, for which there is precedent. UNHCR has, in some half dozen countries, established mechanisms with local guards, wardens, patrols, watch groups, and they have found them to be very effective. And maybe counterintuitively, they have found that these practices based on policing-type functions have actually helped to preserve the humanitarian and civilian character of these settings. Another example is Darfur and the Darfur Peace Agreement. The DPA made provision for the training of individuals selected from the populace to become community police. They're trained by peacekeepers in some of the same functions I just mentioned. Another example is the peacekeeping mission in the DRC. The acronym for that is MONUC. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
It's MONUC.
MONUC. Okay, MONUC. One example there was called Operation Night Flash, where a Pakistani battalion that was woefully spread thin helped organize over 500 villages in just the rudiments of patrolling, of signaling, of early warning, being prepared to flee. The net effect of that was that the battalion was much able to more quickly respond in the areas of the responsibility, and that the area, the violence in their region dropped significantly, substantially. Finally, our beneficiaries, our local partners and staff, have themselves been doing the very things that are mirrored in tactical training. That's an important precedent, but maybe even more important is the fact that they must first learn these things on their own through trial and error. And of course, error is deadly. It costs lives. Our task, I would think, should be to help them shorten that deadly learning curve. To be sure, there are risks in undoing this. This training is apt to be much more acceptable, deemed doable in village and community development settings than it would, say, in a camp or an emergency relief setting. Development entities, of which there are a great many, that have history on site, developed some situational awareness and good, reliable local contacts who have earned trust over time, they're a much more plausible basis or platform for trying this work than, say, camps. Camps may be another story. True, some of the precedents of this cited for you were camp-based, but regardless, camps pose great complications and dangers. There's always going to be times when this is not advisable. I want to be the first to say that. You know, in the camp, we may be too new and too busy to have developed that situational awareness and those contacts, the obvious exceptions being when an emergency extends into months and years, and then those contacts and that awareness do form. Obviously, there can be challenges to this form of training from host officials, as well as even those, say, those autocratic powers in camps. I'm referring to political factions and military factions that sometimes infiltrate themselves into camps. They may, for example, suppose that this training is has a hidden agenda or is somehow politically driven. That would be a not surprising reaction on their part. They may worry that tactical training could affect their control over these populations in camp. You know, sometimes hosts are pushing for people to leave camps as soon as possible, and other times autocratic powers are wanting them to stay for their own purposes as long as they can maintain control over them. Either way, the questions of leaving is a very political decision, and that could be affected by a training that raises people's knowledge and capacities. So there could definitely be resistance to this. Bear in mind, I'm mentioning some of the worst case scenarios as I'm obliged to do, but also keep in mind that all aid has a dual potential to strengthen either civilians or belligerents. So if you're a country director in a relief setting, for example, and you've already rigorously determined that your aid is not being substantially abused, for example, by feeding soldiers or allowing them to monetize your aid and buy weapons, that type of thing, then you might reasonably conclude that this training can also be undertaken in such settings. A calculation has to be made. And together with locals in a given situation, the agency has to determine what's the greater risk, being trained or untrained. Is it best to prepare for future violence or not? Please have a look again at this document. There was a blue sheet, and following that there was a green sheet. It looks like this. Maybe, perhaps most of us can agree that situations that fall more, that are situations that are more aligned with the left column would be more risky, while those that more aligned with the right column would be more feasible. That is to say, obviously you're making a choice about the setting. You're choosing what topics might be possible to impart or discuss in these settings. And you're also considering what pedagogy. Not all pedagogies are like forums like this. There are certainly many discrete ways to be communicating and building capacity. So do bear that in mind as we go. I'm going to wrap this up. I'd like you to have a look at this final sheet. This is basically a skeletal outline. There's 3 10 sheets. And they cover the 3 concentrations of potential concentrations for such a training. It's a menu. It's not a guide. One can add or drop elements as the situation might require. Each section begins with typical local strategies and how they provide a starting point for training. If this intrigues you at all, there is a lengthier paper that was made available on the table too that goes into all this in a lot more detail. Maybe I should relinquish the podium, so to speak, right now to let you know, for those who came specifically to learn about tie-ins to conflict mitigation and management, we can circle back to that, because measures that do prepare communities for violence do have that effect. They directly help to mitigate violence and in some ways help locals manage in their dealings with belligerents, manage conflict. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Casey. Patrick.
Well, thank you everyone for your interest and it's nice to see a change of in terms of the discourse on conflict early warning, because most of what we see in the literature and in practice in terms of conflict early warning systems are very much state-centric and sort of intergovernmental-centric conflict early warning systems. And so this is a great opportunity to start thinking about alternative approaches to early learning, one of them being this more community sort of bottom-up approach to conflict early learning. And so that's what I want to begin with, is just to tell you what, to contrast the two. I've been heavily involved in the former for a few years in developing regional conflict early learning systems at the state level. And what those are, I've come to sort of suggest, are not really early warning systems per se. What they are sometimes good ways to monitor conflict and to basically identify trends in conflict by having a structured way of reporting on conflict indicators and how they change and being able to do some quantitative analysis. So in that sense, I'm not saying that there's no value in doing that. There is. It's important to document violence and to basically bring that type of violence to a level where states can sort of actually react to it and be aware of it, or at least concede that there is a problem. But that's really all I would suggest, and I'll be provocative for the rest of the talk, so that's all really it is. I think there are fancy data sets out there and databases where we keep on adding information on indicators and trends and so on. But we really hardly ever see much response or much talk about response. And there are very good reasons why that's the case. It's far easier to monitor conflict than to respond to it and then to show that you know, you've actually made a difference. But I think what my sort of thinking has evolved a bit and changed over the past few years, I haven't seen much success. And including the project that I've been sort of involved in, which is what has started, got me thinking about, wait, am I actually making a difference here or not? So I started thinking more and more about alternative ways to go about this. And one of the areas that I looked for answers in was the disaster management, the disaster early warning, disaster response community. And what I saw there at the beginning, say, 2 years ago, was a shift in discourse within that community from a sort of centralized, top-down, hierarchical approach to warning and response to a more people-centered early warning response approach. And started reading more on this, connected with Casey, and immediately had very similar ideas on alternative ways to go about doing conflict early warning and response. And so I started pursuing that literature and practitioners and projects some more. And the way that they define with respect to people-centered conflict, disaster early warning response is the process of empowering local communities to basically get out of harm's way, to basically maintain their livelihoods even though there is an external shock, disaster, cyclone, what have you, and to basically be able to weather that storm on their own so that they don't necessarily need external intervention right away. And by definition, first responders are going to be those affected. And one of the things that I've seen in the top-down conflict early warning project or community is really not any attention being paid to the fact that there's some very real capacities at the local level to manage different types of shocks and conflicts to the social environment and natural environment. And we just too quickly label these communities as victims and powerless. And that one of my favorite phrases from Casey's work is, you know, the West, the aid does not arrive until the West arrives. And that's simply not true. And we have cases like in unfortunately now in Burma and so on, where we have this issue of sovereignty. So as long as we start talking about state-centered early warning, we're going to have to deal with sovereignty. And the government of Sudan playing the sovereignty card is Burma as well. And then what? I mean, you can't get in. But if we had sort of worked together with local communities there when things were not as dire and preparing them for possible eventualities like this one, then you know the aid may not need to be as sort of necessary. Again, provocative and blanket statements, but I think we can maybe clarify maybe a bit later in the discussion. So I think it really has to be brought from an advocacy angle, which is what's really happening with the top sort of level conflict early warning systems. We have these trends, we write these reports, and what's really fascinating is recently asked at a conference that Lawrence and I were both at, some practitioners involved in basically intergovernmental conflict early warning systems, what are their measurements of success? How do you know you're being successful? And the answer was, well, our measurements of success are the number of accurate reports that we write, and whether they're on a timely basis. Now, that's what I thought was the answer was going to be. I'm glad that they were upfront about it. And there's nothing wrong with that per se. especially in the context of an intergovernmental or even an ecosystem or structure, there's really, to think that you can do operational response within days or weeks is simply not realistic. But that shows you that there are some limitations, and I think we need to move beyond that particular measurement of success to actual prevention or actually response on its own. If we could just have response after a warning, whether it's even successful or not, that would be a fantastic first step. And so thinking more about these issues, looking at, well, at the field of nonviolent action, which is far more tactical, and you could argue that, in fact, conflict early warning and response is very successful. Just look at instances of nonviolent action across the globe. They do real-time tactical situational awareness, and there's a lot of preparedness and contingency planning that goes through that. And that brings us back to this literature and the practice of people-centered disaster early warning. If you think about earthquakes, I think we would be rather upset if the disaster early warning community only did or tried to do earthquake forecasting and not even pay any attention to preparedness or contingency measures. That's exactly what we're doing in the conflict field. But we're even worse at predicting conflict than the disaster community is in predicting earthquakes. And yet we have no sort of second thought about, hey, what happens if we fail? Just like Casey is sort of pointing out, there are going to be times where we're going to fail. And in fact, it's most of the time in the conflict early warning field. And yet there hasn't been much thought given at all to, well, do we have a responsibility in the event that we actually fail? Which is a bit upsetting, I think. And again, if that happened in the disaster management community, people would think, you know, they'd be crazy. You have to prepare people because you can't really necessarily stop an earthquake. And I think we should really honestly start thinking a bit more like that in the conflict early warning field, because our track record is particularly dismal. But what I want to bring sort of to this conversation is a community-based conflict early warning project that I've been involved in that's just starting out in Timor-Leste, and I was there in January and February. And the idea with this project is really to draw on all the mistakes that have been done before at the sort of state level, state-centric early warning, to draw on some of the work that Casey's been putting together, the work that the Center on Nonviolent Conflict here in D.C. has been putting together, and take a more tactical approach to early warning and early response. So I'll just quickly outline the design of that particular warning system and hopefully try and let you know how that contrasts with the typical sort of conflict early warning project that I've been involved in. But it's not an either-or approach, first of all. And so we're taking a two-pronged approach in Timor-Leste, where you have a national strategy for conflict early warning response, but we also have in parallel a community strategy for conflict early warning response. And all too often, it's the former and you forget about the latter. That never comes up in the other project that I've been involved in. For the purposes of the national sort of level, you have to understand, and one trick here is to work backwards. It's all too easy to start thinking, hey, we need to get our indicators for warning and the protocol for communication and then writing the recommendations. But if you actually start and work backwards and you start with, well, what are the institutions that are present and have the capacity, the mandate to respond, and what are those capacities and who are those individuals? And work backwards from there, see what they can do about something, as opposed to just come up with an early warning system and assume that something's going to happen. But so to contrast, for example, typical regional state-centric conflict early warning systems will have monitors in the field, basically monitoring changes in conflict indicators over time. And then what you have is a very pretty graph of conflict intensity changing over time. Sometimes you can see some trends. Forecasting, they're really bad at doing that. But it appeals to policymakers, and it gives policymakers a quick, at-a-glance understanding if things are getting better or worse. And with the analysis, you have some interpretation and some suggestions as to how the trends could maybe play out. I think that's great. That's, again, sort of a top-down approach. It's, I think, appropriate for the state-level institutions. But we shouldn't sort of assume that's going to lead to response. So what we're doing with the East Timor project is certainly drawing on the best practices of state-based conflict early warning and response and trying to improve on that and engaging more closely with the institutions directly, in fact, and not just providing sort of blue sky recommendations and that, but really concrete who should be doing what, where, when, how, and so on and so forth. One of the advantages, in a way, with Timor Leste is that the government and the capacity of the government is not particularly strong in disaster early warning response or even conflict prevention. So they're very much looking to civil society for partnerships and very much open. And in fact, it's on a number of occasions in discussions that we had with state officials, they were really relieved that they could partner with civil society and sort of ride that particular wave. But now I'm going to move to the community conflict study this morning. the way that I decided to sort of approach this was really to draw on the disaster early warning response, because you have a very strong emphasis on preparedness and contingency planning. And there's absolutely no reason, as I think Casey's articulated perfectly well, that we shouldn't be doing the same thing for conflict. There's absolutely no reason. Why can't we go through drills as well as sort of exercises and so on? If this happens, okay, how will we get out of harm's way? Where will we be regrouping? Where's the food going to be coming from, and so on? There's absolutely no reason whatsoever why we can't go start thinking about these particular exercises. And even if they don't sort of lead to operational preparedness and so on, the fact that you have people thinking about that is already a big step. And that was something that was interesting. When we were talking to local communities around Timor-Leste, it was not intuitive to think about preparedness vis-a-vis conflict. The discussion would always revert back to just a reactive approach. Oh, well, this will happen, and then we'll see what happens. Nothing about thinking ahead about possible contingencies and what we would do about it, which is actually not, I'm not disheartened by that. It just shows that there's a lot of potential to start thinking the way, changing the way people think about preparedness and contingencies vis-a-vis conflict. And in terms of how we do this tactically, this is where you bring in conflict management back into the conflict prevention picture. They're not isolated. The project in Timor-Leste is being coordinated by BELUN, which is basically Timor-Leste's only national NGO, which is a collaboration with CICR, the Center for International Conflict Resolution out of Columbia University, who's under largely. And they have a very strong program on training for conflict management, resolution, conflict mediation, and so on. And this is what you're going to need. When you have tensions escalating at the community level, you're not going to hand in your surveys and your nice trends analysis and send it off to BELUN, who's then going to send it off to an institution. You need to react there and then. And preparing individuals to do that, I think, is the way forward. And it's not rocket science. There's the kind of lessons learned in fieldcraft and getting out of harm's way, but we also have very rich, practice-oriented conflict management type exercises and training tools and so on and so forth. And not to mention, though, that we would want to build on already the kind of local traditional mechanisms that exist, fascinating ones at that as well, at a local level. I'm just trying to provide a little more capacity. So I'm going to finish very soon. But one way to think about the difference between conflict early warning at the state level and at the community level, at the state level you have a very pronounced division between those who warn and those who are warned. Right? It's the UN who's going to warn from 6,000 miles away, those individuals who are facing a violent conflict and who know perfectly well that violence is maybe coming. And the community-based approach is more about the warners being the same ones who are going to also be in trouble and who are going to have to leave. Mm-hmm. The incentive to leave and the incentive to act and like the political will at the state level is very much there. You want to survive. And that's something to really also keep in mind in terms of one of the notable differences between state-centric and community-based early warning. So one of the other innovative components of the initiative in Timor-Leste is that we're also providing funds for rapid reaction. So because sometimes you have local communities and local NGOs that know what needs to be done, but they don't have the extra $500 in order to get something rolling, in order to try and manage the conflict that doesn't get out of, if it's like a well, they just need to build a well because tensions are escalating. They have nowhere to turn to because people are not thinking that conflict early warning should be doing anything like building a well, and yet, So that's what I think the highlights are. Again, it's too early to tell. I'm hopeful, maybe biased, but I think a top-down and parallel the bottom-up approach to conflict early warning is something that's long overdue. And I think has been shown to be successful in the case of Kyrgyzstan, for example. This is a lot of what we're drawing our lessons learned from. So there's hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Linda.
Sure. All right, thanks. And I'll kind of try to bring this a bit down to the practical level at the field, if that's okay. Thanks, Patrick, for mentioning the sort of disaster risk reduction that our community utilizes, because it is really important. It's something that we've recognized for a long time, and I think we're getting much better at it now. But we NGOs tend to work at the community level with our beneficiaries, and so looking at community preparedness in areas at risk for natural hazards, sort of second nature to us now. So we know a place is at risk for earthquakes or for hurricanes, and so we're working with our beneficiaries to ensure that, there's kind of a plan in place for that. And, some things you can mitigate through, irrigation and other things. You can't mitigate a cyclone, but you can prepare for it. And I think there are a lot of parallels that you can draw to conflict prevention, because in a lot of places where we are, and particularly at the community level, folks are really watching. I mean, they know what's going on much better than we do. I mean, they're the best barometer for tension, and are the ones who come and tell us about it. It's also true, and it's something we've been discussing, I think, in our task force, is that often those warnings that are extremely clear and very precise don't ever make it up. I mean, they don't sort of work their way up in the policy circles, which is unfortunate, because we can do a lot of conflict prevention at the community level, but it's not always conflict between communities. It's spoilers and other folks that need to be dealt with at much higher levels than you can do through local planning. So certainly, many of us work in areas of high conflict, and I hope that some of my members in the room will also sort of jump in with some comments. But one of the things that we do have to do, and in case you mentioned this, is work through distance management. So a lot of times when things get too difficult or too dangerous, the international staff will pull back. Maybe pull back from the field into the capital, and sometimes even have to leave the country. But then we often, if we've been working with our staff and we have relationships of trust and we've been doing training with them, which is what we should be doing in the first place, then there should be clear lines of responsibility that have already been laid out, and that work can continue. I mean, we rarely pull out for very long at a time. It's usually relatively temporary. But sometimes it has been for longer than we'd be comfortable with, and there is that relationship of trust that's really important, but we also have to realize that we're putting our staff at significant risk because of this. We do, because the security situation is sort of a lot different than it was 10, 15 years ago, I mean, we do a lot more security training with our teams, and that includes our national staff. And in the security trainings that we do, we do involve evacuation scenarios, so we do talk to them about what's going to happen if we have to pull back? How do we make sure that all of our, all of the bills are paid? How do we make sure that, the assets are protected or not? I mean, in some cases, I would certainly much rather someone take all our 4x4s than hurt one of my staff. 4x4s, you can always get more. You can't buy another guard. So making sure that it's clear to them that, they're not to put their life on the line over stuff. Stuff isn't important. Again, we do have the clear lines of responsibility. It's very clear that if the senior management is gone, who's responsible for what, and having those lists in place, making sure that people know what's supposed to happen when it happens, significantly decreases their stress level when it actually does happen, because there isn't the sort of kerfuffle and who's doing what and who has the keys to what. Again, in these evacuation scenarios in our plans, we tried, to the extent that we can, to limit the risk of our national staff because of perceived access to money and assets. And so, if we have to disable the vehicles, if we have to, destroy some assets to keep them from being put at risk, then we'll do that. And what we also want to do, we encourage in these discussions, we want our folks to be thinking about what they're doing at home. In the same situation, if we're worried that a rebel group is going to come in and we may have to pull out, we want to know what they're doing at home for, stockpiling food, what have they been talking about with their neighbors and their family about what they would do in these sorts of situations. And so what we try to do, to the extent that we can, is model behavior for our staff, who can then go back and model behavior in their neighborhoods. The UN Department of Safety and Security, which is sort of responsible for, UN staff, but also in many cases for the NGOs that are under their umbrellas implementing partners also include national staff in their security plans. And so there is, you know, there's sort of lines of responsibility, and it's clear to the staff what it is that they're supposed to be doing. As we take this out to the community level and the people that we're working with, I mean, there are some bits of the tactical training that make me slightly nervous, because, you know, when we start to talk about local policing and things like that, I mean, the last thing I want is some untrained person with a weapon, you know, under stress. So I'm hoping that this is policing without weapons, because, right. And I would imagine some of our friends who are working in Iraq would have something to say about the local militia groups at the moment. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can do at the community level, you know, looking at prevention and mitigation. I mean, if you're in an area where there are ethnic tensions or religious tensions, I mean, actually incorporating those issues into your programming can help to can bring communities together and can mitigate violence, so that when something bad happens, when the spoilers or the rebel leaders or whatever are trying to recruit people, that folks would be less likely to go, or that if there's a greater ownership of their village and their community, that they'll resist to a certain extent. Again, there are certain things that are just going to simply be out of the community's control. When people come in with heavy weapons, that there's a certain amount of stuff that they're not going to be able to fix. And I have to say that, I mean, my experience at the field level has been that, you know, most of our folks in our communities don't actually need our advice on how to react to violence. I mean, most of these people, again, in places that I've been working, have been exposed to violence for a very long time, and they have very sophisticated coping mechanisms that are in place. And those are the things that we need to be asking about and learning more about, see how we can support them or strengthen them, or at least be aware of what they are, so that we're not trying to sort of impose another set on top of them. They know how to react to insecurity and violence. They know it much more intimately than we do. And actually, we should. You know, there's quite a bit that we can learn from them.
Great, thank you. So all the speakers, we have a little over half an hour for discussion. Let me just offer one or two quick thoughts as we open it up. One, just would be interested in comments from the audience. To what extent you or your organizations are engaged in projects that reflect some of the themes you've heard about from the panelists, and are there some vignettes or illustrations that you might help add to the picture? From my perspective, where my portfolio here at USIP really focuses on conflict prevention, I worry a little bit that there's a certain sense that we should sort of give up on prevention here, or at least give up on prevention in the way that we generally think about policy level instruments and actions that have potential to change the conflict dynamics and remove the ultimate or the fundamental drivers of the conflict. That worries me a little bit. Chick Dombach, who's here, often points out that this is a relatively young field. Do we have enough experience and enough evidence to say that this is simply not going to work and we should then focus our attention on preparedness for inevitable conflict? But with that, I open it to the audience. Let's try and collect two or three comments, and then we can go to the panelists. And please introduce yourselves.
Should I talk in English?
I think it's okay.
I'm Susan Shepler from American University, and I want to respond sort of to what Linda was saying about they know much better than we do what's going on. Mm-hmm. We can learn from them. Mm-hmm. By sharing a story from my own work in Sierra Leone, when I was working in a small village, and sort of assuming people will warn me when things get bad. When I actually was evacuated in May of 2000, my neighbors sort of saw that as, things must be really bad. They're evacuating the white people. In other words, the information flowed from the top down in ways that they didn't know. And so this leads me to my question about information flow. That I think there is this sense that information about what's going on the ground is going to flow up from the bottom, and yet sometimes there does need to be information flow from agencies. You know, all the NGOs who were working in Sierra Leone were getting the updated reports about what was going on, and yet my neighbors didn't know what was going on. They knew what was going on in their little neighborhood, but they didn't know that rebels were, 50 miles outside the city, for example. And so in terms of, I want to push us towards kind of information flow and what kind of things people could do in terms of radio programs or just information about location of where are the rebels that people could use to make their plans.
Great, thanks. All right, Chick.
Well, one of my, you already said part of what I would have said, so that's already covered. But I think kind of adding to that concept that we don't know enough yet. This is a new field. We're just now starting to pretty pay serious attention to this area. The concern that I have is our genuine ability to predict or anticipate the outbreak of violence. I guess something I'd love to see USIP do or somebody do is take a look at the various warnings and track it over a period of time and see how many of them actually played out and then see which ones and what characteristics of which ones seem to be the most accurate so that we can do a better job of actually anticipating and predicting. The best analogy, of course, being the weather, where they use multiple regression analysis and on that basis get more and more accurate over the years and the decades and come pretty darn accurate. We're not even remotely close to that yet. We have a number of things that happen. We say, therefore, this is a volatile state. Therefore, we've got to be ready. This may break down into violence. The accuracy of those predictions, though, the probability that it's actually going to end up being a violent environment, we don't know very much at all yet. So any of your thoughts on that and how we can become more accurate? And part of the reason that's so important is we have such limited resources to put into violence prevention. If we can improve our prediction capability, then we're more apt to apply those limited resources where they really are needed and not have it dissipated among all those places out there that are on the warning radar.
Comments?
I've come sort of started to, when I got into the field of conflict early on, I'm very much excited about the potential for forecasting conflict analysis, trends analysis, and using all kinds of sophisticated sort of modeling and so on and so forth. But then it sort of dawned on me that even if we were, and I have no doubt, if we were able to actually have some kind of forecasting system that was correct right more times than not, I'm not convinced that would actually lead to reform. What was really interesting, a study I did with a colleague of mine, Fletcher, Savannah Campbell, on the UN, was looking at the response structures and the decision-making structures of the United Nations, different agencies, different offices over the past 10 years or so, and carrying out a number of interviews with the decision-makers themselves. And at no point in our conversations did anybody say, they drew on a formal conflict early warning system to make a decision. So you work backwards, and they're making decisions, but there's no link to any kind of formal early warning system. So so I think the idea of doing forecasting is one that is important, but it's probably the role of academics. And they can continue the modeling and so on and so forth. I think policymakers in general are a bit skeptical. They see modeling as a black box, and they don't really trust it, which goes back to this issue, the first question that Lawrence spoke. Concern that you posed, should we give up on conflict prevention? So I would go back and say, well, you don't need sophisticated trends analysis and sort of fancy graphs to do prevention. I think prevention more often happens at the diplomatic level with phone calls, with conversations, and so on and so forth. These diplomats do not need necessarily to see sophisticated modeling equations about conflict forecasting. So we're not by any means saying that conflict prevention we should give up on in terms of operational prevention diplomatic initiatives. In terms of I don't view preparedness as distinct from prevention. I think preparedness is a form of prevention. Because if you prepare people, then they would hopefully survive and maintain some kind of livelihoods that would allow them to continue. So I think that's in itself preventive. It may not be prevent of the entire macro political conflict, but I don't want to wait until that gets resolved and have more people in harm's way. So that's sort of where I see this. Does that sort of answer your question?
No, it just provides a perspective.
A perspective. It's a very biased perspective.
Linda Casey.
You can go first, I'll follow up.
Okay. Alrighty. I want to absolutely agree with a couple things Linda said, and that locals, whether they be civilians or our staff, they have coping mechanisms, and that we can learn from them. That is the absolute premise of our approach. If you do have a chance, if you remain interested in this, have a look at this, and this will describe the very ways that tactical training comes directly from classic coping responses that civilians have shown over time. That is the starting point. That is, you start with where they're at, and you start with what they trust in terms of responding to violence. I don't entirely agree that they don't, I mean, it's not cut and dry, they don't need our advice and that they know how to react. There are far too many, survival testimonies brought to our attention by Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, et cetera, where they didn't. You know, sometimes they don't know the rules of change. They might be relying on past experiences, on instinct, et cetera, and they just might not know that this time it's different. And so it might sound conflictive, but we can learn from them, but at times they might need a little extra support in terms of capacity to be more aware of the situation, how the rules of the conflict might have changed. All conflicts change, and their intensity gets worse, and people are off guard, caught off guard. And I want to also, secondly, assure Lawrence that this has nothing to do with giving up on conflict prevention. Please consider it absolutely complementary. You could think of it as different things happening at different canopies or levels. The relationship should be one of looking at it as an insurance policy or a contingency plan. I mean, the practitioner should look at it that way, and the village should look at it that way, too. And also bear in mind that this field of conflict prevention, it has had its unfortunate shares, not just failures, but unintended consequences. I mean, at the macro level, some say that in instances and places, efforts to help strike a political solution actually triggered or prompted violence, preemptively type of thing. I think that's rare, but it's always a concern. My concern is actually more at the micro level, where our work with people, as it should, gives them a greater sense of consciousness and feelings of empowerment. But that could be a dangerous thing at the very time that death lists are being drawn up. Our founder, Fred Cuny, had probably his most searing experience was in Guatemala when he was organizing master carpenters. Now, who would think that, master carpenters would become a target? Well, they were carpenters / community organizers. They were respected people, and they became targets for that. You don't necessarily know when our work, we have our exit plans, but we don't know when our work is going to maybe defer steps for their survival. They might postpone. They might feel that our imprimatur means the spotlight's on and that they are protected for us. And a lot of conflict protection people will say that that is one of the benefits of this. We're showing our presence and concern. But that doesn't always turn out to be the case. Sometimes civil societies, be it Haiti or other places, El Salvador, are wiped out after we leave. People we groomed, we worked with. So I think it's very compatible and maybe an essential element that's been neglected. It should be considered part of the discipline, my view.
Sure. I mean, to talk about your prevention thing and how do we focus limited resources. I mean, that's something I think we're all kind of facing, sadly. But I think the issue, one of the problems is you can't sort of say, okay, things are starting to look bad here, we need to do conflict prevention, because that has to have been there for a long time. And so I think we need to just sort of do a better job of kind of looking at where are the places that are most likely, and how can we start putting in long-term programs in way ahead of time, and then hopefully our measure will be conflict avoided. It's hard to measure that or show a picture of that to Congress to increase funding, but I think we can, that should be what we're aiming for. Look, happy, peaceful society. We were successful. But one of the questions too is when we're talking about early warnings, where are the warnings coming from? Because there are so many different levels of information. And I mean, I have to say, in many of the places where I've worked, I mean, it was evident to us that bad things were happening, and that information was going out in many different directions through the UN and others, but nothing ever really happened. And some of that is in places that are was a very little national security interest, and some areas were more significant national interests. But you know, as you probably well know, I mean, the embassy folks don't get out much, and they don't always believe what their aid colleagues tell them who actually do get out, and then the NGOs and the other folks and the missionaries and folks like that who are actually working on the ground with the communities, yeah, their input is rarely, you know, considered. And I think, you know, we knew what was happening, what was going to happen in Rwanda before it happened. We knew what was happening in Eastern Congo before it happened. I mean, and Darfur as well. And right now we're watching Abyei, which is basically a slow car crash. We've all known that it was coming. And, you know, many people were predicting, you know, a resume of hostilities in southern Sudan within 18 months. But are we seeing any really strong diplomatic efforts there? I mean, I would argue that there's lip service, but I don't see a lot of pressure being put on as a, you know, as a community. And so then the question is, where is the, if all the information is there, where is the will? And I think that's one of our biggest challenges, really, is once we know, once we're pretty sure something bad is going to happen, who wants to fix it?
I guess part of my sense is, though, that if there were a higher degree of confidence in the forecasting, that it would mm-hmm. be, we would more effectively mobilize mm-hmm. the political will to do something. So to the extent that we can improve that forecasting mm-hmm. capacity, mm-hmm. It, and I would like to think anyway, yeah. that, mm-hmm. and I look at private donors, mm-hmm. that we deal with far more than the government donors. If I can go to mm-hmm. the Medicaid Nobel Ballenstein who's mm-hmm. you know, doing this kind of thing, we're trying to find mm-hmm. we're trying to find a dozen Nobel Ballensteins. Mm-hmm. If we could find them and then be able to say, here's a place where there we have an 80% probability mm-hmm. that if nothing is done, it's going to break mm-hmm. out in violent conflict. Mm-hmm. If something is done, then that's going to reduce mm-hmm. it to a 20% probability. If you can do that, mm-hmm. then I think some of these people would get out their checkbooks and say, yeah, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can make this kind of a difference. Mm-hmm. I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from, and mm-hmm. would like to see us continue to work toward improving our ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. And that's your opportunity. If you're able to get that kind of reliable, trusted warning to begin efforts at the higher canopies, international levels, and at the same time, there's no necessarily contradictory problem here of having them happen at the same time, concurrently, that you're working more with your staff for the day they may be left alone and for the communities.
Absolutely. I'm not I'm not looking at a conflict between the two philosophies and approaches at all. I'm just saying that whole area of improving our ability to understand the drivers and what really is apt to lead to it is just an area that I think we have a long ways to go. I've said, or as we say before, we shouldn't be giving up on it, for God's sakes. We're just getting started.
In terms of a government perspective, you know, we oftentimes put our funding into our foreign policy priorities. So yeah. Liberia, anyone could say that the work we're doing there is conflict prevention, but you don't see us doing the same work in Cote d'Ivoire or Guinea Bissau or anything like that. And mm-hmm. so yeah. that would be an argument against early warning. At the same time, learning from our most recent mistakes, our government, we are working a lot more on conflict prevention, not from Office of Foreign Aid for Reconstruction and Stabilization in the conflict prevention unit. And jokingly, I often say it's an oxymoron to be a prevention officer working in a government that's mostly reactive. But at the same time, the fact that my office even exists, mm-hmm. I think is sure. evidence that we are becoming more proactive in terms of our prevention. And you know, I go out to rollout about these stability indices, and we were just at the Civil Peace Index yesterday, and I think, what's the point? Because I don't see how it actually affects my work. But if there was some, and we have the NIC one that's supposedly our Bible in terms of that, but if there was actually some proven results, then the itty little bit of funding we do give for prevention, we could be putting in that direction, as opposed to saying, well, you know, there are 30 countries that need our immediate attention, but we're too busy putting out the fires in our foreign policy priorities. So we're moving there.
Mm-hmm. Roshan?
Roshan Paul from the Harvard Graduate School. Good question. Casey, you said a few times that this would be advisable in some places and not advisable in other places. And as we are from organizations with certain institutional mandates for certain regions of the world or certain thematic areas, how do you, as an organization, start to see whether it's advisable or not? What are the kinds of criteria that would decide whether a particular situation was applicable for this kind of effort? Or even if we don't have the actual criteria, how do we start making those kind of stuff? How do we start thinking about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, threat indicators, sets of threat indicators are a dime a dozen. There's plenty of tools out there that an agency could choose as far as being predictive and seeing whether this, feeling that, within 4 or 6 months out, we may have to pull out, or, within 4 or 6 months, we think we're going to be seeing people leaving these communities or these camps type of thing. The sets of indicators are certainly available, and some major NGOs have created their own, and they'd be hybrids of existing ones type of thing. I don't subscribe to any particular one. I think that an agency has enough of those tools to choose from, and then with good people on site, it's going to have a strong sense. If it is, again, we're talking about agencies that have been on the ground for a while, and agencies that are willing to have a training like this, but with the use of local co-trainers, otherwise I wouldn't even attempt it. So it really depends on how well situated you are, and what tools you choose that exist out there for monitoring the situation. But, a lot of agencies are already trying to do this. I don't mean to say the training. They already have in-house methods of assessment.
Not talking so much about the conflict analysis or conflict early warning, but the assessment of whether a situation is ripe for a community center, the practical training kind of approach. So,
sure. Yeah. Well, this decision's made jointly with locals, all right, whether it's your local staff and implementing partners, or whether it's locals in the communities that you've been working with for a long time. Part of it's an examination of the coping mechanisms that they're already beginning to think of, what they're doing with their assets, what steps they are already taking, because the training is going to start with what security steps they're taking, and what kind of, are they getting their households on a kind of a, their household economies on a crisis footing type of thing. The agency is going to be talking with local leaders about the appropriateness of it and learning at the same time what steps they're already inclined to do. It could be a place where you've had cyclical violence and they'll have a whole repertoire of things that they're going to be inclined to do and they could tell you about, maybe, maybe not. But it starts with a conversation that might sound imprecise, but it's consultation, because it's not going to fly without their buy-in from the beginning. That help?
Sir? Yes, I'm Ramon Dao, born with the Inter-American Foundation, and I teach at the George Mason Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. I'm not sure that my take would be of interest to you folks. I come from a slightly different side. We do development assistance, and we work at the community level. And my unit of analysis in my mind is the community as a dynamic system. And I'm not an expert in conflict. I do realize, though, that tension is a universal presence in human relationships, also human relationships, and that managing of those tensions has a lot to do with conflict, I assume, or the mismanagement or the poor management of those tensions. And the tensions, as the tensions arise and shape, etc., I visualize a community as, colors in the surface begin to change and show the tensions and bumps and blisters begin to emerge. And then as forces outside begin to impinge on that community, the breaks may happen in unforeseen areas of the community as it breaks up. So it is the internal tensions. And I wonder whether, when we talk, I find this very operational, what you're all saying, and the measuring and preventing and whatever. And I wonder whether looking at the inherent tensions in every community and as within themselves and as reflecting the larger tensions of the society. You mentioned Guatemala and El Salvador. I know the cases very well. And I'm thinking particularly about Bolivia. I mentioned in my little paper there, as Bolivia seems to be on the verge of explosion, and it is, you can see the blisters and the bumps coming out in all sorts of places. Whether actually looking at those tensions before they, in fact, which are a universal presence, I repeat, before they emerge into conflict, might be an indicator of, by looking at the colors of the community, what's getting redder or greener or bluer, might be helpful in anticipating these kinds of things. And I was hesitant to speak because I seem to be a different angle on this, but I'd like to hear your comments.
I mean, so you're saying looking more at the kind of root causes of the conflict?
Well, root causes is very passive. Actually, I mean, you walk into a community and you spend the day there and you can sense who likes whom, who hates whom, the different colors and ages and genders and social classes and where they came from, and it's there. I mean, the tensions are pulling in all directions. Mm-hmm. If you just attune your antenna, you can sense in a community where the tensions are. In the community, not to mention the stuff that's brought in from outside, with the larger political pressures begin to pull in one direction or the other. So when the community breaks up, you can almost visualize where the break is going to happen. And I wonder if that angle might be useful to you folks, because I really would like to learn from what you do, because it affects very much what I do.
This is, I mean, that's you're totally on the spot and on the dot. Like, this is not foreign at all. This is really good, and I think we need to continue conversing across disciplines in any case. That's exactly what we're trying to do with the Timor-Leste project. It's not just reporting back to the institutions about what's going on, but actually working with the community and providing this regular, ongoing training with CICR on conflict management, conflict resolution at the community level. Mm-hmm. It's really made for that and targeted for that. And then obviously based on cultural issues as well that arise that we need to take pay attention to. So we're applying our knowledge in conflict resolution, conflict management, conflict mediation together with the local community, empowering them to help themselves manage those tensions without having to have us in the middle alone. Mm-hmm. And obviously, again, it's not imposing all this, but it's very much also a conversation. Because, I mean, that was part, I think, some of the most fascinating conversations I had was actually learning from the local communities about how they manage conflict traditions.
Or don't.
Mm-hmm. Or don't, and how things get out of control and so on and so forth. But those are the conversations that need to happen. That's where the knowledge is. The knowledge is not the conversation that takes place. So,
so we should talk some more.
No, but this is right on, I mean, of course. And unfortunately, again, I'll just say this one more time, when we think of conflict prevention, we all of a sudden, for some reason, just forget about conflict resolution. Oh, we're doing conflict prevention, so we're not going to touch about the skills or anything or experiences in conflict resolution. That's just wrong. It's completely wrong. So, at least in my perspective.
Okay.
You know, I feel a little guilty that this was billed partly as conflict prevention, and there are strong, as I said, connections in tactical training to conflict mitigation and management. If I could take a couple minutes to draw some lines together that are dots connected that may have never been connected in your minds before, I'd appreciate it, and I'd love to hear what you've got to say about it. But there are most definite security coping strategies that civilians have used in crisis in and out of societies across the world over time that actually have very important ramifications for conflict mitigation and management. And this training supports their capacity to do these things. And I want to see if it all falls together and makes sense for you. But consider two very central things that civilians do in the face of impending violence. They've got to make some choices. Two almost very diametrically opposed choices. The first are, we're going to try to accommodate the belligerents and the violence that's approaching, accommodate these individuals, or are we going to try to avoid them? And quite often it's a sequence where the first see if they can deal with belligerents. I don't mean this in a partisan sense. I don't mean accommodate in a loyal sense. I mean they make pragmatic concessions for survival's sake to stay where they are and suffer tolerable demands if they can, lay low, hope the violence will pass. That's very common. But sometimes they're also a little bit more proactive about it. That is to say, they'll pursue ways of actually dealing with those who are abusing their communities. They may try to make deals for safe space, for separation of combatants and non-combatants. They might try to declare their neutrality and have that respected. They might try to broker agreements or understandings involving their free movement, maybe on market day or in medical, in times of medical need, such like that, some kind of leniencies. They may try to deal with belligerents. There are many examples in which local leaders have bargained with armed powers to create a safe corridor, town, or zone, or some other arrangements. But you know, when that fails, then they're also faced with the choice of flight. Okay, when accommodation fails, the, as we all know, because they end up as our clients in these camps, hide and flee by the millions. We've had actually a little interest in learning from their experiences of past hiding and flight, and we don't typically imagine them going through these experiences again in the future. If you're a relief worker, you're pretty much working and living in the moment. And we don't, those lessons are lost on us. At any rate, there's vast amounts of historical and social science accounts that are showing the civilian evasive tactics that are used, and the tactical training I'm talking about reflects that. These are methods of information management. It's ways to collect, analyze, and disseminate facts. It's communications, safe sites, safe movement, and threat response. These are things that often happen in very elemental ways by families and communities on their own without the, even using that terminology. By the way, these are things that we already teach to expatriates. These are field craft that we teach to expatriates in different variations, but not to locals. But, you know, it's not hard, for example, to see avoidance as conflict mitigation. I say that for two reasons. One is obvious. The more prepared people are for violence, the fewer are going to be touched by it. And that seems to be one legitimate way of at least mitigating the scope, the impact of conflict. But there's another way, and it's really not given that much thought in the literature, is that the more prepared their social units are and their economic assets are, then the less fodder and less fuel there is for conflict. What many of today's conflicts want from defenseless communities is fighting bodies and fungible assets. They want materiel and manpower, conscripts and contraband. But what happens if training goes right to the heart of that? Many of today's conflicts are characterized as asset-stripping enterprises more than conflict, you know? So families and communities that strip first, so to speak, offer less provisioning, less profiteering for these forces. You can compare it to a BTU rating, the British Thermal Unit measures intensity of heat. Well, communities burn, and the question is, you may not be able to do much in the end to prevent conflict, but you certainly can do something about a community's BTU rating and how much it's going to feed conflict. Will all of that remain in the path of violence and be taken up like in a firestorm, or will it not? I mean, that seems to me to be one legitimate path to conflict mitigation, a little unconventional description of it. And the other big concern is conscription. Okay, this is kind of conflict mitigation in the trenches, so to speak. Beyond the long-term poverty and grinding injustice issues that we know fuels recruitment, there are more proximate and precipitating threats that come with the outset of conflict and push people into one armed camp or another. I'm talking about the collapse of their sustenance, the breakdown of their services, especially health care, and loss of security. This makes people desperate. This pushes people into one camp or the other. This is often referred to as the center of gravity of conflict. You know, control goes to the side that either can give or take away these elemental things from the people. Join us, you get beans, don't you get bullets. So sustenance, survival, and security are at the heart of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and they often happen to be the three concentrations of tactical training that I've been talking to you about this afternoon. Belligerents try to convince people of their utter reliance on them, and reliance comes at the price of alignment. We'll protect you, you're with us. But tactical training, conversely, urges capacity building for greater self-reliance. So the more self-reliant you may be, perhaps the longer you can stay non-aligned in a conflict. There's plenty more, we could talk about that later, but won't have time at this meeting.
That's back here.
Please.
Has there been any mapping activities been done to kind of map out the entry-level training for students creating collection efforts for governance. This is an issue that came up with the latest round of FEMA proposals last September. I think we just like that, you know, I mean, maybe in academia somewhere, someone has done this, there's a school that everybody's aware of that I haven't seen. But, yeah, is there anything that's been done that's available somewhere? Kind of, we were having this issue of, you know, it's already been done a million times in this area, and we're just not aware of it.
I mean, I think it'd be kind of hard to do that, because I think a lot of people do conflict prevention stuff in a lot of different styles of programming. I mean, you could map up where, you know, aid or the donors are paying for, you know, specific conflict prevention or mitigation programs, but, you know, most of responsible NGOs, when they're doing any kind of programming, need to be working, especially if you're working in a conflict environment, you need to be working these things into it. If you're going to, you know, if you're building infrastructure, you should be including, you know, different ethnic groups, so they build something together, so there's an ownership there, so that when, if conflict breaks out, that isn't then destroyed, you know, those sorts of things. So I think it'd be hard to define that, but you could probably look at the NGO community and see who's kind of looking at focusing on these sorts of things, and several, you know, many people have been writing on it. We actually, not to do an advertisement, but Interaction actually does have the Transition, Conflict, and Peace Working Group, and that might be a good place to start. And actually, Adrienne Paul, who now has a different last name, was the co-chair of that, so you might want to ask her about
that's
that.
Good. I figured someone else in the organization kind of knows
yeah. that. Yeah, but I mean, if there seems to be a value in going more deeply into that, I think, I mean, I'm sure that would be not, you know, something that folks could do.
Yeah. I realize that it probably exists somewhere.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking of locally and being in Northern Uganda recently, finding out from the totally religious leaders, you know, what was going on. Like, this is wonderful. I wonder if they know about it somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's certainly a good point that we don't always document. Like, when things start to go right, we're not really interested anymore because you've got someplace else to go. But I don't know, Chick, you're part of the TCP working group. Have you guys ever done anything like that? Or has that been part of the discussion at all?
Not directly.
But, you know, it could be something to talk to OCHA about, too, because, you know, we've got the who, what, where for all the disaster responses, you know.
Take the two comments right here.
I was possibly just wanted to go a little more into what you were talking about, Casey. I'm not sure if I quite understood what you were saying. I'm Emily Gish, I'm with Mercy Corps. First of all, when you talk about the choices that people have when they are faced with conflict, and you said accommodation and avoidance, and I think possibly the biggest one that was missed there was the choice to fight back and prolong the conflict and what happens in that situation. And then you talked about when people choose to avoid or they choose to flee, you know, having them strip their community of their assets, and then for that, I didn't quite understand what you meant by in that helps to not fuel the conflict anymore, but then you have people who have fled, and while there may not be as much violent conflict, then you have a different type of disaster or humanitarian situation that you need to deal with, that I think is the point of preventing the conflict in the first place. That's all. I can't remember what my other point was.
I think there's a comment right behind you, and then we'll go to the panelists for their final word.
Yeah, it's actually a frustration. We have been working for Mali since 2003, and I'm just wondering, Patrick, if you know, you have any model or any of the panelists, if there's a model that has been mapped out, you know, looking at the Mali situation, and given that most conflicts in that area will most definitely follow that pattern, staying for Mali, because. I mean, I wouldn't know, I don't know if you'd know, if, like in human beings, it's so hard to predict what kind of violence is going to come up. I mean, we didn't know Kenya was going to react like that in last year. So it would have been easy to predict if really what form it would take, but we know what form Somalia is going to take. Have you guys started out anything, any methodology, any way we can deal with that kind of violence in the Horn of Africa? You know, maybe Djibouti, Eritrea, and Somalia for the suit.
Let's take final thoughts from the three panels. Do you want to just go down the line here?
Sure. I don't know of any initiative in Somalia or outside of Somalia that monitors conflict escalation, does conflict forecasting that I would even recommend. Again, I think with the case with Guinea-Bissau and Milk Project, they didn't really do conflict forecasting. They went up to David Collins' group in Carleton University, did a conflict assessment, a structural conflict assessment, identified three or four different countries that looked like they weren't getting better, and then chose one for a number of different reasons, and then decided to do something about it, which is, I think, highly commendable, and I recommend this project to a number of them. But I don't have an answer. I think I'll leave this hard question for Casey, because I think he's going to but on the previous question, with respect to sort of the two options that communities face when conflict escalates, there's the sort of resistance aspect to it, and then there's the sort of evasive maneuvers and just go on the ground and survive. On the former, I think that's where, again, I don't understand why we would want to divorce nonviolent conflict, strategic nonviolence, from conflict prevention. I really can get tired of hearing this. There's a rich, rich history, right, of nonviolent action. There's a lot of lessons learned, a lot of case studies. There's a great organization here in D.C. Headed by Peter Ackerman that actually does hands-on training with local groups involved in resistance. And the idea is that nonviolent action is a force more powerful. That when you do have nonviolent movements engaged in resistance, the transitions to democracy, if when they happen, tend to be far more sustainable than armed rebellion. And I think what really appeals to me as well about the nonviolent community is and the approach. It's very tactical. It's very hands-on. It's the warners warning themselves as well. It's about situational awareness and so on. So I think there are many manuals, there are many guidebooks out there and that really detail how to manage different conflict and how to ultimately undermine the legitimacy of the regime, because that's really what nonviolence is trying to do. It's trying to basically convince the military and the pillars of the regime to switch sides. And one way to do that is to provoke the government into taking a certain type of action that's going to be disproportionate, and the rest of the pillars, military or what have you, say, this is not on, and they switch sides. And in order for resistance groups to do this effectively, they have to know how to get out of harm's way, right? To sort of provoke and then meet, but provoke in a non-violent manner. So I hope that answers the question that you talked about earlier.
Any final thoughts?
I'm on the same page with Emily as far as like concern about assets of civilians who are in the way of kind of rebels moving back and forth or armed groups moving back and forth. Because part of this is colored by my own experience, but where I've been working, most of my beneficiaries have been extremely poor rural people who didn't have any other option for their assets. Their assets were goats. And so the military either would come in and steal their goats and eat them, or, so they could strip themselves of the goats, but then they wouldn't have any food afterwards. So, I'm not sure that would have worked for that particular population, but maybe there's, other considerations. If we look at, Bosnia and different places, that might be something slightly different. For Somalia, that's such a huge challenge, because I think we all know it's a huge problem, and it's such a big, knotted issue that most people don't even want to try to unravel it. And I think that's part of the problem. I think that's part of the problem there. We've having discussions with policy folks. We don't seem to get very far. And I'm not sure that that's the. I don't want to judge because I'm not a Somalia expert. But I think many of us would welcome a little bit, delving in a little bit further, because folks are out there trying to address humanitarian needs at the community level. But again, I think that's a clear situation where something has to be done at the at the higher levels in order for us to ever have a resolution there. And that's much more into the resolution. It's way beyond mitigation or prevention, I'm afraid. But you're right that the bordering countries, the attention needs to be paid there, because things like this can certainly leak.
Great. Casey, final thoughts.
Thanks. Time for the siren there. Mm-hmm. Is it Emily?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that's a perfectly fine question. That was a section of the training I didn't even really get into any level of detail with you today. The context here for considering helping get people's social assets mobilized on kind of a crisis footing is that far too often they end up in our camps absolutely destitute, or they end up with their trusted first responders with nothing but the shirts on their back, and that has implications for them and, of course, for what we have to do in ways of care and maintenance for years afterward. Stripping and transferring, and I'll explain in a minute what stripping means, has triple benefit. One, it does keep their safeguard their assets. I'll explain what assets, certainly a lot more than goats involved here, has three benefits. It safeguards their assets. And if they transfer their assets, at least temporarily, perhaps until a conflict passes, what they've done is they've transferred it to the people they trust the most. The first line of responders is not us. It's I used to work with Mercy Corps. It's not Mercy Corps either. It is certainly their trusted social family units. In so many conflicts, they show up to these people after a forced migration, and that outlet for them is soon exhausted. The first line of providers that they go to are often just as poverty-stricken as they, and often can't help them for too long, and that then leads to secondary, tertiary flights, which are equally dangerous. Imagine if you had the presence of mind to some months earlier transfer some of your assets to that and bolster that first line. And thirdly, by doing that again, you've taken it away from the belligerents who are going to strip your community, in the next week or next month. You've kept that out of their hands. Now, there's lots of different ways to kind of transform and strip assets. You can cache supplies, anything that's mobile. You can kind of, so to speak, weatherize the very important money networks for you, your local lending networks, your remittance networks. That's one huge thing that you might not see it by looking at a village, but in Darfur, that was, in many cases, the single most important aspect of their livelihood was remittances. Well, we've got to weatherize those systems. It's very good that in times of conflict, remittances go up while we go out. I mean, that is true. Remittances are hugely important.
What do you mean by weatherize? What do you mean by weatherize?
I'll explain that. It's just a kind of a short handle there. These systems for cash transfer are vulnerable, both the communications that are so important to remittances and the actual physical movement of the remittances or disrupted by conflict. So by weatherizing, I mean tactical training and those very two things. Those are two of the core elements. In the case of remittances, you'd be thinking ahead about having alternative couriers, alternative destinations. If you're forced and there's no longer a standing address for those monies to go to, people who are sending that money are going to know what the fallback points are. You'll have to think of perhaps alternative transfer, cash transfer agents, because some of them will be pushed around by conflict, that kind of thing. The same with local lending networks. There are ways that we haven't even gotten into that an agency that feels it can pull out can set up promissory notes or voucher programs before it goes, so that lenders, local lenders, even shopkeepers, who are very important in these times, can have the assurance that the agency will cover debts type of thing while they're gone. I'm really not even scratching the surface. Assets can be dispersed sometimes. Rather than one farm lot, have three. So it's not all lost in one raid. We would have farm lots in the forest. This is things they already do. Diversifying your asset base, turning to subsistence, which is the classic thing. Well, you'll see people turn more to wood gathering and gathering fruit, forest products and all that type of thing. The problem is it's dangerous while you're moving and trying to do that kind of subsistence. So there's fieldcraft for safe movement. So the starting point always is what they're inclined to do. They're often inclined to, if they think ahead, liquidate their assets in Burma, Cambodia, other places. They would often convert their assets to jewelry, portable, travel with it. So a big part of this is the mindset, thinking ahead. You don't want to be liquidating assets at a time. That'll cause depression on the market. People will sell panic selling. So the idea is to think about it far in advance and spread it out a little bit so the predatory instincts of buyers aren't aroused. Otherwise, if you wait to the very last minute, you're going to get nothing. You're going to get no return on the assets you're trying to sell. They do try to sell them because they know they can't run with them. So the whole thing is I haven't even scratched the surface. But important thing too is all these things are reversible. Okay, if you're in Darfur, emphasize goats more than camels. Goats are going to be more durable. They're going to be more hardy and mobile in the places that you're going to. That type of thing. It's just ways of shifting around. Maybe stop. Don't plant. Harvest this time. Maybe rent out your land because you're not tied to land and harvest. There's lots of ways to go with it. That type of thing. Just to say that I haven't really scratched the surface. So if you're interested in learning more, in the paper that was handed out, you have my email, and we could certainly talk more about it.
Well, I hope that collectively we've at least scratched the surface in this time. Thanks for staying with us a few minutes over time, and thanks for all your input. And join me in thanking the panelists.